24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. It is July 30th, a terrific Tuesday. Remember, we're going to make it terrific. We've got a cram-packed show. We have Wayne Elliott at the second half. But first up, we have an incredible writer. This is an amazing story. Please welcome Robin Harding to the show. An impressive literary career. She has written 13 books, and you can go and look on Amazon. They have thousands of reviews. She has one book with 21,000 reviews. That is so hard to do and so impressive. We're going to ask her about how she does it. She has a new book out called The Haters. It is very topical. It is about hatred and high school and stuff like that, and people who get mad at teenagers, and we'll talk about the book. I want to let her describe it and getting bad reviews and what happens when you get a bad review or a book that you've published and anything. We'll talk about it. She is also going to tell us how to have a perfect family life and deal with Chihuahuas, the most annoying dogs on earth, and still have a very successful career. Robin Harding, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Jim.
All right. So how did you feel when you got your first bad review?
Oh, God. So I started writing. My first novel came out in 2004. So this was a really long time ago before social media. And, you know, now we've kind of all become used to, you know, seeing negativity, and people are very comfortable you know, reaching out online and saying, making comments, etc. But back then, there was none of that. And it was my second novel. My first novel was some charmed situation where I never really got any bad reviews. And I remember my first bad review was from Publishers Weekly, and it was for my second novel in like 2005, maybe. And they hated it. And it took me months to get over it. I was devastated. And to think of having such thin skin in today's day and age, it feels like a different person. Because now I have to be used to it all the time.
Yes, very true, very true. Do you like or dislike the fight back feature when you can reply to the review and give your take on it? I have also been published, Robin, of course, not as nearly, you know, as much as you, and I get hurt by the literary reviews. I co-published my first book, co-authored, so it's their fault, not mine, whatever the people didn't like. But we also rent our swimming pool, Robin. We're on an app called Swimply, which is sort of like Airbnb for swimming pools. And we're the number one in Georgia, 183 reviews. We got one 4-star review, and both my wife and I were devastated and wanted to quit.
I know. So the biggest rule in publishing, and probably any industry, is don't respond, right? Don't engage, don't respond. And in my book, the author is a debut author, and she doesn't really know the ropes and doesn't really listen to advice. And she does engage, much to her detriment, because it all devolves into an absolute nightmare. But, I certainly understand the temptation, but it has been really hammered into me over the years by publicists to just let it go.
Okay. I try to reply only to the good ones. So
yes.
When they say,
yes,
we're famous for our elephant ears. Our elephant ears are 10 feet tall. And we actually on the news, they mentioned our elephant ears. And so it's part of our shtick now, you know, part of the brand. That's how lush it is. We have 10 foot tall elephant ears. And so one person commented on that and asked, you know, kind of offhandedly, how, you know, what we did, I wonder what they do. And so I responded back, well, I cut them back every year. And then, you know, I fertilize them in the winter and then I bring them into the house and put them in the, you know, bassinet at the end of the bed during the winter and, you know, sleep with them and give them bottles and comb their hair and, you know, so anyway.
Well, now I just want to go to your pool.
Well, yes, you can pull up the pictures. It's in 30328. It's run by zip code. We are the Sandy Springs Pool and Hot Tub. You can see our backyard and all of the stuff we've put in. It's a great little side gig business for us. You know, it's the essence of the gig stuff. So,
yes.
How did you get your first deal in writing? Was it your publicist or your agent that you first got, or did you get a publishing deal first? Robin, I actually got my first publishing deal was a contract with McGraw-Hill. One letter, 1 week letter later, no agent, no publicist, no help. A week later, we had a deal with McGraw-Hill. I've heard that's kind of unusual. What was your story? And then you have, you know, the best of all time, Harry Potter, took her 100 rejections.
Yeah. So I had, you know, one of those blessed first book situations, which I now think of it sort of as a blessing and a curse, because I did sell my very first novel I wrote. I submitted it to a bunch of publishers and agents, and I got an offer from a publisher and an agent on the same day, believe it or not. And I ended up signing with the agent who sold it to a different to Random House, actually, and then sold to the publishing offer I got was from the UK. So he sold separately to the UK. And I'm still with that agent. So, you know, it's been a really long 20-year relationship with him, which is fabulous. But I say it's a blessing and a curse because I think I thought when I sold my book so easily that my whole career would be so easy and nowhere to go but up. And a career in publishing, a long career, is it's a real roller coaster. It's, you know, you're up, you're down, you're sideways, you're in, you're out, you're reinventing yourself. It's unlike any career that I have had before. Or, you know, I see my husband who just, you know, he gets promoted and promoted and promoted. And it's just not like that in publishing.
All right. So give us some advice. Walk us through some of the basics. I'll throw out a category and you give us your best take on finding an agent.
Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, I have not found an agent for 20 years. So I've been with he's the only stability I've had. I've had a ton of publishers, but I've always had the same agent. But I do know that, agents are always looking for the next new thing. So when people say, oh, I'll never get read, you will get read. So submit, I think you can just submit, you know, partial manuscripts, outlines, query letters. Most of them have websites. When I did it, you still had to mail so long ago. You had to like send it in the mail. So now I think you can just submit partial manuscripts. They'll say what they want. And I do know that they read. They have a stable of readers and they're always looking for something new and exciting and an original voice. And so you will get read.
Okay. And what's going to make them say yes to you? What's the secret sauce to having that intern go, yeah, Bob, read this one. This is the best one I read so far.
Yeah, that, I mean, God, if I knew, I would write a book about it. It's, I don't think anyone should try to chase trends, you know, like, because a book takes a long time to write. It takes, you know, 9 months, 12 months to write a commercial novel in my experience. And if you're trying to jump on a trend, By the time you've finished your book, that trend will be over and it'll be on to the next thing. So I think my adage I always use is I want to write something that I personally want to read. So, you know, also I have to spend all those months with this story and with these characters. So I want to find them interesting and engaging and exciting. And I hope then that editors, agents, readers will find my stories the same.
All right. How do you find your stories?
So I keep a little file of ideas. So I'll hear something, you know, in the thriller genre, it's really fun because, you know, so many things you can turn into a thriller, I find. You know, I'll hear a little scenario from a friend or I'll see something on the news and it's like, ooh, that could go wrong. That could turn into someone's worst nightmare. That could devolve into a murderous revenge plot. So I keep the premises in a file, just, you know, like one sentence. And then when it's time for a new book, I go back and I look at them all and go, okay, which one grabs me? Which one do I want to pitch to my editor and, you know, create a plot and characters and setting around that premise?
How do you physically write? Do you dictate? Do you type into a computer? Do you long legal pad and pen? Are you off secluded in a treehouse, or do you do it in the kitchen as the kids walk by and the chihuahuas just be ugly? How do you physically do it?
Yeah, so I have a little office in my house, but it's also office/ spare room. So there is a bed in here. I always say I've never seen a writer have an office without a bed in it, because it's usually an extra bedroom or, you know, some kind of multi-purpose space. But it is, for, you know, most parts, my writing space. And I do type on my computer, and just I used to write longhand sometimes, but when my kids were younger and I'd take them to the park or something and I'd write in a notebook, but now I have the luxury, I guess, of working here in my own quiet space, and yeah, that seems to be the most productive for me.
How long do you write for? How many words do you produce in a session? Help us work through the, I have to produce 100, 150,000 words, whatever your target is, and I have, you know, 6 months to do it. Do you kind of do that math? Walk us through the number part of writing a book divided by time.
So I don't do that. And a lot of people use, there's all sorts of new writing software. Scrivener, have you heard of that?
I have.
Yeah, so a lot of people use that, and it really tracks like all your words and what you've completed that day. And I think it sets your novel up in scenes so you can move back and forth. And I don't know, it looks really cool, but I don't use it and I don't keep track. So I sit down and I'm like, today I'm on fire and I'm going to write as much as I can. And other days I'm like, this is just a struggle and maybe I'll go back and edit. So, you know, I have tried to keep track, and then I just peter out and don't follow through. So the haters, I actually had a fairly tight deadline on this one, because just the way it worked out with my editor, it took her a while to get back to me and give the go-ahead on the idea. I'd written 3 chapters and an outline. And when she finally pulled the trigger, she was like, can you hand this in 6 months? And honestly, I should have said no, just because of my own well-being. I feel like the book is, I'm very proud of it. I feel like it wouldn't have mattered for the book's sake if I had more time. But for me, I was so drained. I was just like really pushing myself. And so I got it done, and I always meet my deadlines, but I'm like, no, I need longer than that to enjoy the process, as opposed to feeling like I'm just busting my butt every day.
What is your ratio of write book to promote book?
Oh God. You mean time or enjoyment?
So you're saying you hate talking to me. What I took from that, Robin, is you don't want to be here.
No, I'm loving this. I'm loving this. But you know, it's funny. I do feel like, I bet you I spend about a month and a half really heavily promoting. And it's not, I love chatting with you, Jim. This is awesome. But you know, I'm on social media like all the time. And that is now in an author's contract that you will promote on social media. And, you know, as the haters, if you read the haters, that's exactly what it deals with, is that vulnerability that when you're engaging on there, not everything you see will be positive. And like I said, I've got thick skin now. I get it. But I do like when I'm in promo mode, I just long for the, you know, the solace of, you know, diving into my next project and just kind of being in that world and not feeling like you're always trying to sell. But, you know, that's business. It's a business.
Yes, it is. Do you have time when you're not promoting the book, when you're just not available for interviews and stuff like that?
Well, I'm going on a holiday soon, and I'm going to Greece. So someone literally just asked me if I would do their podcast while I was in Greece. And I said, no. I don't know what time difference it'll be. I don't know what my internet connection will be. And I think I just need to be in the moment and enjoy my break. So, I don't know. Everybody has a different level of hustle, and, I give it a good shot, but I do definitely think I need some downtime.
Yes. But in addition to that, will you come home and say, you know, for the next 6 months I'm writing and not going to do any interviews? Don't bother me then.
Well, yeah, no one seems to really want any. Usually when the book's been out for a while, people lose interest in me. Okay. So,
got a strike while it's hot.
Yeah. My publicist, you know, they set everything up for me. And so they do it all around publication. And then, you know, I have it in the fall. I am going to a couple of writers' festivals. That's kind of festival season here anyway. And, you know, that's always kind of good promotion, and you do panels and talk with other authors and network as well. And, but yeah, there doesn't seem to be the same, you know, I'm not doing radio interviews and I'm not writing articles anymore. And so you're kind of just left alone. So I think that's kind of my struggle, is that it's so, solitary, a writer's career, until it's suddenly so, you're so on for about a month, and then for 11 months, you're just like barely speak. You're just alone with your computer and your chihuahuas and, you know, not really out there hustling.
Which of your books will make the best movie, and are you making that happen?
So I have two books under option right now, and I have to say I've been very fortunate. My 13 books, I think all but two have been optioned at various times. And some have been optioned multiple times, but, you know, nothing's actually happened. And so I'm very realistic about Hollywood. I remember the first time I got an option, I was like, yes, it's going to be a movie. This is great. I've made it. And then I realized that that doesn't actually mean it's going to happen, but it's always hopeful. And, it's also, you know, a nice, shot in the arm that someone else sees the value in your story. So my book, The Perfect Family, is currently under option, and they have a script. And then The Drowning Woman, which is my most recent book before The Haters, is also under option, and they've got cast attached. And, so fingers crossed.
Ooh, cast. Do you like the casting decisions?
I do. I probably shouldn't say, because I'm supposed to, well, because I've been told not to say. It's not anyone I would have thought of, but she is great. And she's a pretty well-known person.
Kate Blanchett, you know. I heard it was Kate Blanchett. That's what I heard, Robin.
Okay, maybe not that low. Did you?
That's what I heard. I mean, I'm not, you know, starting the rumor. I'm simply promulgating the rumor, you know? And if that's not who it is, then it's not my fault, you know? I heard you wanted a lot of money and the double-wide trailer, you know? The double-wide trailer is so ostentatious these days. Will Smith killed that for everybody.
And she wants to hang out by your pool.
Yes.
While shooting.
Well, you know, it's on the app and you can rent it for $60 an hour. Anyone can. So
nice.
Robin, great insight into your extraordinary career and congratulations. Thank you so much. And we'd love to have you back to hear about the latest when it comes out a year from now. How do we find out more? Follow you online. Let's do point out that Robin has her, of course, own website, and it's robynparting.com. Right?
Yep. That's right. That's right. And I'm on Instagram at rhardingwriter and on Threads and Facebook, author Robin Harding.
Fantastic. Robin, thank you so very much and congratulations. I'm not a hater.
Thank you.
I give you a good review.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Have a great day, Jim.
You too. And we are out of time, but you know what we do? That's right. We come back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care and go write a book. Bye now. Read a book. Write a book. Do a book.
Bye, bye, bye.
We are back. And again, thank you so much for being with us on Tuesday, this terrific Tuesday. Wayne Elliott and I are writing a book on the environment, and we are doing research interviews. And so I thought it would be useful for you if we played some of those interviews, and I will interject from time to time and say, this is what we're getting for. This is going to be chapter three, whatever. So the process, I think, is useful for you to hear. We're going to jump in the middle of our conversation with Wayne Elliott, Canadian entrepreneur and super environmentalist. Even though you don't know about him, that's the thesis of the book. Here he is.
Well, I was going to talk about the U.S. shipbreaking. And just to give you the quick version, for years I tried to get involved with the U.S. Maritime Administration ships and the warships in America.
Right.
And for a while, quite a while, you needed a $5 million bond per ship to bid. Well, to get a $5 million bond, you have to put up $5 million worth of stuff. I never had that back then. So I had to sit on the sidelines. In the meantime, two of the papers I wrote, they took to your U.S. Congress. They knew I was an expert. I just couldn't play it with the rules. And then it's funny, you know, I'm an environmentalist, and Al Gore really finished the greatest opportunity that we'd ever have, and I'll tell you why. We won two aircraft carriers on the West Coast out of Bremerton, Washington, the Hornet and the Oriskany. These were 33,500-ton small aircraft carriers. For us, it would have been 4 to 5 years' work. So we arranged to lease a yard in Astoria, Oregon. It's on the, in the middle of a rainforest. They had just closed the facility that was loading all pulpwood to Japan. And it just closed. Everybody laid off. So we made a deal for the site. Thank God I didn't sign the lease, because the day I was supposed to sign the lease, Vice President Al Gore put a moratorium on shipbreaking in the United States that lasted 4 years. No ships were broken. And it was because of the environmental carnage, mostly caused by the self-proclaimed godfather of shipbreaking in the United States, Mr. Richard Jarosz. But he had a congressman and a senator as close friends. And in those days, you could do everything but commit murder if you've got two of those fellas on your side. And he polluted all three coasts. Brownsville, in North Carolina, he got 17 ships from the Navy. And instead of doing it properly, like we do it, He went after all the lead ballast ingots in the side tanks, the propellers off the ships, which were manganese bronze. And he ended up killing a man. A man got killed on that job. And when they came to investigate, the ships were all leaking chemicals into the ocean. And they took all the ships back, towed them all back to Philadelphia. The government did. They had to patch them all to do it. You can't run in the ocean with holes in your ships. So it cost the government millions. But because of his connections, he never missed a bid. He just went on to another yard and kept getting ships. Well, anyway, we didn't get those two carriers awarded to us because Vice President Gore put this moratorium. Now, here's the sadly ironic part. There hasn't been a U.S. shipbreaker on the West Coast for over 30 years now, mostly because of Richard Jarris. He was in Long Beach Harbor, and he lit the flight deck of the carrier, the Bonhomme Richard. This is right in Long Beach. You got mega-million-dollar condos, can see the job. And the deck of the Bonhomme Richard had 4-inch-thick cedar, I believe, planks covered in a fiberglass resin. That was the flight deck. He just lit it on fire in Long Beach Harbor, the whole flight deck. And he had a submarine there that he'd been awarded and a guided missile cruiser. So they shut him down, took those ships back. And so there was no U.S. shipbreaker on the West Coast. Had we started at Astoria with those two carriers, what happened 25 years ago now, or 23 years ago, they put in the rule that you can't take a ship from the Pacific Ocean and go through the Panama Canal into the Atlantic Ocean because of the growth and the different creatures in the two oceans. So what they have to do now with the West Coast ships, take them into San Francisco dry dock, blast off the bottoms and all the growth and barnacles and whatever's on there, and then they can tow them into the Gulf, to Brownsville. So we would have been... Now, all that exercise I just told you costs about $2 million per ship to do. Being on the West Coast, we wouldn't have had to do any of that if Vice President Gore hadn't made that decision and we had to open up that yard. And we'd have had a $2 million leg over every other bidder by virtue of being on the West Coast. And that's the story. So... we'd have made a lot of money if not for Vice President Gore. And isn't that ironic? I'm an environmentalist too. He did the right thing. I mean, it was a mess. Lives lost, pollution everywhere. He did the right thing. But in the end, we were the biggest losers. So I don't know if that's a story you want to talk about on the radio or not.
Sure, let's talk about it. But how did that... I mean, the decision to not have ship breaking on the West Coast, those ships have to be broken. They can't just sit there and rot. What did they expect to happen?
People take them into the San Francisco dry dock, sand or water blast them, and then tow them wherever you like. You could go into the Atlantic. You could go into the Caribbean. You just can't have any of those creatures on the bottom of the ship from the Pacific Ocean. They really... You know, we have fish in the Great Lakes now that are eating everything. We have cormorants, ocean seabirds, in the Great Lakes eating all the fish. Invasive species, they call it, right? They don't belong in the lakes, just like the East Coast, the Pacific Ocean creatures don't belong in the Atlantic Ocean. So that hence the requirement to go into dry dock. So you're talking about two tows. You got to tow the ships from Bremerton or Sassoon Bay, California, up to San Francisco, put them in the dry dock, blast them off, and then you can refloat them and take them wherever you want. Well, being on the West Coast, if we were in Astoria, Oregon, we wouldn't have had to do that. It'd be one short tow from Bremerton to Astoria, no dry dock fees, no blasting. So it's ironic that he did that, and what the never mind the two carriers, just imagine for the last 25 years if we had a $2 million advantage over any other bidder per ship. That was the net effect of it.
And what happened to the guy that you were talking about, the competitor with all the political connections?
he borrowed $32 or $38 million from a group in Toronto I know. Now, I have no idea why a shipbreaker would ever have to borrow that kind of money. It's there's no reason he'd have to buy it. You could outfit the yard with new heavy lift cranes and everything else, and you couldn't spend that. But he was a con man. He got the loan, had a carrier delivered to the yard, and then declared bankruptcy. So he had the $32 million to retire with, plus any other money that he'd made. And the guys in Toronto got beat for their money. And the government had to take the carrier and contract it somewhere else. He'd be 80. He'd be in his 80s now, Richard Jarris. He's out of business now. But he single-handedly polluted all three coasts of the United States.
And is there any ship breaking on the West Coast now? What's going on now? No.
None of the three states will allow it. None of the three states will allow ship breaking, California, Oregon, or Washington. Pretty much because of him. But back then, whenever Vice President Gore was vice president, it was in the 80s, when we went out and made that deal for Astoria, won the two carriers, made the deal for the yard. But thank goodness, the following day of his announcements, the day after Vice President Gore's announcement, we were to sign the lease in Astoria. So it would really have been bad news for me had we signed that lease with no work for 4 years.
Yeah, that would be horrible.
So I was lucky and lucky and unlucky in the same instance.
And what about the rest of
the ships since? If we only did two ships a year since, for 20 years, 2 times 40 ships, $2 million edge per ship, that's $80 million in profit, plus whatever we could have got away with profit.
And what's the rest of the U.S. industry like now? Are we doing any breaking on the East Coast?
That I tried to buy once, and then I tried to work with the new owner, and Marriott wouldn't allow the ships, even after decontamination, wouldn't allow them to be towed to the East Coast of Canada for us to break. I waited for the court case. The Sierra Environmental Club sued the U.S. government for exporting ships because they had exported 15 or 17 to England and PCBs on them and all the rest of it. So it was actually against the law, and Sierra Environmental sued them. I waited the years while that court case went on, had the deal with this fella in the Chesapeake. He'd decontaminate them. We tow them up to Cape Breton Island. And so when they won, the government won the case. They won the case with Sierra. And when I called the manager of MARAD, U.S. Maritime Administration, told him the plan, he said, "We're not going to do that." I said, "You won the right to do it in court." He said, "We only went to court because nobody's going to tell the U.S. federal government what to do. We had no intention of ever exporting anymore." So, you know, that fell through. Then I went to Brownsville to try and buy out Richard Jarris and his partner. They had two ships in the slip in Brownsville. That's where 90% of the U.S. shipbreaking is done, in Brownsville, Texas. Because as one guy said, they're a long way from the Texas Water Commission. That's the environmental state agency. And, excuse me. So I went to Brownsville. I see these two ships. They were the same, not warships. They were freighters, ocean going freighters, identical. But the way they were sitting in the water, I knew there was something wrong. They were too low by the back end, by the stern, too deep. And I said to them, there's a problem with these ships. Why are they sitting like that with the rake that's on them? They're so deep at the stern. And because they knew I knew what I was talking about, they admitted, they said, well, there's 5,000 tons of solid ballast in each. I said, what kind of ballast? You know, they can use iron pigs, they can use lead pigs, they can use different things, steel punchings. I've used many things selling ballast to people. They said vitreous clay. Vitreous clay, I never heard of that. Well, in the United States of America, vitreous clay is hazardous waste. So they were trying to sell me two ships with 10,000 tons of hazardous waste in them. And obviously I didn't go for that. And that's really the last time I looked at going to the United States to break ships. You know, we're busier here. If not for Vice President Gore, my career would have been finished, would have carried on and been finished in Oregon, Astoria, Oregon, and made a lot of money.
Don't we break the ships better than, say, if they're done in Korea or some other place? Isn't it better for it to happen in the United States than anywhere else in the world?
Well, not Korea. They know how to do it properly. China knows how to do it properly now. Belgium has an excellent shipbreaker. England, I'm trying to think of their names. It's not Acme, but it's something like that. They've done ocean rigs and everything. But it's certainly better in the United States than Turkey or India or Bangladesh or Vietnam, where it's a 100% total shit show, excuse my English. Asbestos in the water, oil in the water, no safety equipment. They used to say in Alang Beach in India, a ship a day, a death a day. Only that was an understatement, Jim. There was more than one death a day per average. But life is very cheap there. The workers were getting 20 cents an hour. The women were getting 7 cents an hour. They had women in bare feet because at Alang, they can't bring the ships ashore. They run them under power as fast as they can up onto the beach. Well, oftentimes they're a quarter mile from the water's edge. So in low tide, they walk out there, and they used to pull them with hundreds of men and a rope. High tide would come, and men would pull to bring the ship closer. And the women with no shoes would go out in the water, and they would lower down mattresses and mirrors and toilets. And the ladies would carry them ashore. 7 cents an hour was their pay. So, you know, we can't compete financially with those Asian breakers. But between the death, the injury, you know, Taiwan used to be the biggest shipbreaking nation until they had two terrible accidents. In dry docks, too. 60 men were killed in a fire on one, and I forget, 200 or 300 on another when the ship rolled over in the dry dock because they were dismantling it improperly, thinking nothing could go wrong sitting on a dry dock floor. Well, it sure did go wrong, and Taiwan banned ship breaking for good in their country. And since then, it was just countries like Bangladesh and India, very, very poor countries, that took up the slack. Right now, about, I'd say 90% of the world's ships are scrapped between India and Bangladesh. And Bangladesh, they pay less money than they do in India to the workers. Terrible. Just terrible. The carnage to humans and the environment. And in Turkey, they have one yard that got ISO certified, and he supplies the other 26 yards with ships. And it's a real shit show there. They just struck. They went on strike. All the workers in the 27 yards the same day went on strike. And what they were after was $450 a month pay. You know, here, workers get that per day. So
how do you compete with that, Wayne? How is it possible for you to compete with that in Canada?
Very, very difficult. They towed the ships out of Montreal. That's where they take possession. Cost them about $1.5 million to go across the Atlantic under tow, plus a fuel surcharge. And we can't compete because the men make less than a month than our guys do in a day. And we follow all the rules. We even roll ships out of the water now, so nothing could ever go in the water. And there in Turkey, they only grab them by the bow and the stern where all the pollution is. That stays afloat, swings around, and wind and storms. And so it's a slight step above the worst breakers in Asia, Turkey is. But they have that one certified yard, and he fronts for the 27 yards to get ships from Canada. So that's our biggest competitor is Turkey. And it's very, very difficult to compete. Whenever we do, it's the price of scrap steel that determines whether we make or lose money. And more often than not, we lose. We lose money. If it wasn't for ships on the Great Lakes and owners that refused to tow their old ships that weren't built for the ocean to start with, they're Lakers. And when their steel work gets too ripe or rusty, structurally unsound, they tow them across the Atlantic to Turkey. We've tried to stop it, but Transport Canada just hasn't done that. Of course, you must remember the two biggest ship owners in Canada on the Great Lakes. One is a former prime minister, and the other is a former senator. So, the old story, Jim, of who you know and who you are.
Why don't you just give up in Canada, Wayne? Sell off the machinery, and is it worth the fight? Will the next generation have the moxie to continue this fight?
Well, it's you know, truthfully, it's looking worse all the time because costs only go up. All costs only go up. They never come down. For example, the price of asbestos abatement has basically doubled every year in the last 10 years. It's probably our single biggest cost. And of course, the old ships have asbestos. The steamships are just loaded with asbestos. Just loaded with asbestos. And it's very, very expensive work these days. And in some of these foreign countries, if they have any protection, it's very little. And in fact, in India, they reuse the asbestos. There's a film called The Big Break, where they featured us and compared us to the Indian yards. And they actually had men sitting with no protection, no respirator, on the beach, taking the asbestos, rubbing it through their fingers to take the paint chips off, and then bagging the asbestos in bags for reuse. No protection. You know, those men will have asbestosis, lung disease. It was a very sad show. They interviewed some of the workers, and they have no choice. It's a four-hour ride over a rough corduroy road to get to the hospital. Many guys have died on the way. It's just terrible, but they you know, they're poor people. They have no choice but to work in those conditions. So, no, I expect that America is much smarter than Canada. You guys won't export your ships. And in Canada, we do. We do. Even though they're not safe, they're not built for the ocean. Very big difference between ocean-going vessels, Jim, and Lakers. Lakers have a flat bottom, and they're actually square in shape. Ocean-going vessels have a deep V keel, the bottom of the ship. And that's to take the different seas. The seas in the ocean are longer. They're longer seas, so the ship the likes of a Laker, when both ends could be out of the water at the same time riding a big wave, they can break in half. And for years, 1 out of 20 doesn't make it. 1 out of 20. If you go back 50 years, the average is 1 out of 20 doesn't make it. And there's no insurance. You don't have to have insurance on vessels in international waters, so when you think of what could happen running into other ships, sinking and the environmental carnage, some poor family could be out in their sailboat through the night on autopilot and run into a ship, you know. So it's I find it odd in this day and age that you can tow a ship around the world. Once you're in international waters, there's no requirement for insurance of any kind.
Interesting. I never knew that. And then what happens if something does happen, the boat sinks and there needs to be an environmental cleanup? Who pays for that?
Well, that doesn't happen too often in the ocean. It doesn't happen too often in the ocean because there's all kinds of pollution out there from tankers and ships sinking. One in Canada, a novice who had never done a ship or towed a ship or had anything to do with a ship before, bought a ship called the Canadian Miner. It ended up on the richest lobster fishing grounds in eastern Canada called Scattery Island. And this guy, he didn't have a naval architect report. He didn't have an emergency tow line. Didn't have a spotlight on the tug. He didn't have a spotter watching to make sure the ship was still behind them. So it broke loose through the night. And in the morning at daylight, they noticed the ship was not behind them. And when they turned around to find it, it was already up, to God's truth, up on Scattery Island. And that cost the government of Nova Scotia about $30 million, and it cost the Coast Guard a bunch of money, too. About $30 million by the time the ship was removed and dismantled. Just because the guy had no insurance, had no emergency. I mean, it was amateur night the whole way, and yet they were allowed to depart with the tow. So,
and he doesn't end up in jail or with penalties or anything like that?
Not a thing. He was a foreigner. He wasn't a Canadian. So, no, absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. No. So, you know, it's a very serious thing. I mean, ships are large vessels. It's not like parking the car over in the lot there. They take large dock space. Is always at risk. If you look at Norfolk, Virginia, I've been there twice when hurricanes have gone through and a bunch of Navy ships piled up in the corner of the harbor. You know, 10,000 tons afloat is a dangerous thing. Take out bridges, take out boats. I mean, it's been amazing to me how what's been gotten away with. And of course, we've tried to be the best in the world. We're the oldest active shipbreaker in the world, our family is, and we pride ourselves in what we do. Never had an insurance claim in 50 years, never had an environmental carnage, never had a charge or a I forget what they call notice of violation notice. You know, we have really strived to be the cleanest shipbreaker in the world, and we are the most experienced for the longest, we're the longest, oldest active shipbreaker in the world. And we've prided ourselves in doing things the best that we could, and yet it's that very thing that makes it so difficult and will eventually have us out of this business.
Do you think that eventually Canada will step in and make it even more difficult and close you down somehow? Do you think that environmentally you'll be allowed to continue?
Well, I don't think that's the issue because we're inspected by a lot of agencies, Coast Guard, Oceans and Fisheries, Environment Canada, St. Lawrence Seaway Authority. We do everything right and properly. But I thought you were going to ask, do you think Canada will ever change the rules and make it impossible to tow ships that aren't built for the ocean, old ships that aren't built for the ocean to start with? No, I don't think they'll ever stop that. I don't think they'll ever stop it. And if we close shop, there is no production shipbreaker in Canada left. we're the only production shipbreaker. By that, I mean, we do commercial vessels, but most of our livelihood has been commercial vessels, freighters. So we are the only ones. There's another one in Nova Scotia that's done only government work, government ships, and Navy ships, and that was our competition for all of that. But they've never done any commercial shipbreaking, go and buy a ship and recycle it. They've only done jobs where they get paid well. So I would imagine if we were to stop our work, you know, tomorrow, then everything will be exported. We bring a lot of ships from the United States, just not government ships, Jim. A lot of commercial lake freighters we've scrapped. Dozens and dozens and dozens of them. So it's kind
of
sad.
And what about the United States? Do you think the U.S. will allow it to continue in Brownsville?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I mean, you have to do something with these. When I started trying, Jim, to get involved, there were over 450 ships mothballed in the United States. In the Chesapeake, the James River Reserve Fleet, they had them. They would lash 8 or 10 ships together, bow to stern. They'd tie the ships together. All the ships would put their anchors down. So it was a very secure way of storing ships. You know, Norfolk had ships. I'm trying to think of the place in Beaumont, Texas, Sassoon Bay, California, Bremerton, Washington, Philadelphia. At one time, there was 450 ships awaiting disposal. Now I think they're down to, here we are, you know, 40 years later. I think they're scrapping 6 or 8 a year now. You know, you guys in America, you never stop building new ships. Canada hasn't built a new Navy ship in half a century, I guess. All our fleet's old. There's no more destroyers in Canada. They've all been scrapped. And they were our biggest ships. They're among your smaller ships. But they were our biggest ships, the destroyers. They're gone. All we really have left is frigates. We have 12 frigates left in Canada. And thank God for the United States of America, because I'm not sure we could defend Lake Erie, much less our huge coastlines.
Well, I'm not sure we would even try.
Hey,
I don't know if we would defend our own coast.
Well, President Trump said he's going to make countries pay their way at NATO or suffer the consequences, and Canada has been a country that for many years we haven't met our obligation of armed forces, people, ships, or money. And as I say, thank goodness to the United States, because if anything broke out in the world, we would certainly need America to help to protect us.
What are your thoughts on overall environmental policy in terms of, you know, we have to do some of these dirty things? Are we being too strict?
Well, I think, you know,
setting ourselves back?
I have mixed feelings on it, Jim. Some things go to, I'm an environmentalist, I swear to you. I believe in keeping the earth clean. We're not going to be the last, I hope we're not going to be the last generation here. And we have to think about future generations. And we haven't done a very good job at that in the last 100 years. You know, we didn't have an Environmental Protection Act in Canada or the United States till 1970. And by that time, you could almost walk across Lake Erie. It was that polluted. You know, because companies were allowed to just run the pipe into the lake. There it is. It's gone. Chemicals, gone. No, it's not gone. It's there. So, you know, we needed a lot of these laws, these regulations, and but in some cases, it, my opinion, it goes too far. My friend and our partner at the Strauss company in BC, he has a small place on the river in British Columbia, And he has a boat and a portable dock that he would put in every year and take out in the winter and so forth, and to enjoy his boat. And a tree from erosion fell into the water. It just got, the bank got eroded and the tree fell into the water. Right, two-thirds blocking the little river and right in front of his house. Well, here's where I think they go too far. That tree is definitely going to die. It just fell over. Its roots are sticking up in the air. He was not allowed to remove the tree. Nature had to take its course. And that, I think, is going too far. On the Great Lakes now, with the Conservation Authority and Natural Resources, the fish, and I know this from personal experience, the fish in the lake have more rights than the property owners on the shore. And when I said that to an officer, she told me I had a very good grasp of it. So, you know, in some cases, I think we've gone unnecessarily far, made things expensive and difficult for ourselves. And in other cases, I don't think we've gone far enough. I just don't believe old vessels that are much weaker than when they were built new and that were built for the Great Lakes with the shorter seas, the waves closer together than in the ocean where you get the long swells. I don't believe those ships should be towed over the ocean. If you just look at the record, one out of 20 hasn't made it. Let me ask you, Jim, I'm not a guy who likes to fly in airplanes. Most people do. Would you fly in a plane again if one out of 20 crashed?
No, of course not.
Of course not. Of course not. So why are we still doing what we're doing with old ships? You know, so in some ways they don't go far enough. And another way, in my opinion, and in other ways, they go too far, where humans with maybe sizable investments get inconvenienced over a dead tree. You know, in my opinion, that's just going too far. You know, they're doing everything to protect the species, local species. That's reasonable. That's good. You know, when I was younger, I thought, well, if we lose the frogs or we lose the turtles, it's not a big deal. Well, it is a big deal. It's a very big deal. It's the way nature works. There is no unimportant creature. Every creature has a purpose. In all the studies, they believe that salmon, very popular food for humans and bears and birds and bugs, they believe the reason nature put salmon on the earth was to feed other creatures. But that's their purpose. But everything connects in nature, and there's nothing that the Creator put here for no good reason. So it is a big deal that we're losing species like crazy. If you watch any of the television documentaries on this stuff, I've learned a lot on some of those. And with people like Dr. David Suzuki, a famous man here in Canada, he's a Japanese man. I was on a panel with him once at the Toronto Environment Film Festival with regards to shipbreaking and what was going on in China. And it wasn't televised, so Dr. Suzuki really let it all hang out. And this lady asked a question, well, geez, how can you expect the poor Chinese people to protect the environment? And he said, listen, as long as you people want to buy, this is exactly what he said, as long as you people want to buy that imported crap at Walmart, and you will keep buying that, what do you expect to change? And he told me when we had a chat before the event started, out on a park, out on a bench out on the street in Toronto, I said, how you doing, Doc? Nice to meet you. He said, mostly I'm ticked off. I said, why? What's the matter? He said, for 40 years, in layman's terms, I've been giving people the science of what's going wrong, and nobody's listened. And he said, I'll never write another book, and I feel as though it's all been for nothing. He's a wealthy man, of course, but it's all been for nothing because nobody's listened. And look what we're doing now, Jim, this carbon, you know, the carbon that's that's causing us all this trouble and heating up the earth. Well, you know what we do in Canada? We just tax it. So the government gets money. There's no reduction in carbon, but there's a tax on it now. Our gasoline, I think, went up almost a dollar a gallon with the carbon tax. Now, how does that do anything for the environment? Just more money for the government to spend, that's all. So
well,
I know there's
said.
A lot of people that don't believe in the environment and what we're doing. I think it's really a selfish way to look at things. You know, you can't deny the facts. You can't deny global warming. But we just seem to be most concerned, you know, with the here and now. And it's one of my frustrations, Jim, that's for sure. I mean, we're little people up here in Canada. All of our businesses are environmental, and we do a great job in our small way for the environment. But it's kind of like the flea on the elephant's back, you know. We're just small companies up here in this corner of the world. And you know, they're just, in some important ways, there isn't enough being done. And then in ways that just seem wasteful, they've gone overboard, in my view.
I would agree. Wayne, let's wrap it up there. And I'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Thanks, Jim. Have a great day.
So I got about 5 pages of notes for the book. I can't wait for you to read it. Anyway, thanks for being with us today. Back tomorrow with normal stuff. All right, bye now.